Case number 22-3035 et al. United States of America v. Brittany Jones, also known as Brittany Elise Nancy Jones, appellant. Mr. Jones for appellant Brittany Jones, Ms. Millian for appellant Willis Lewis, Mr. Goodhand for the appellee.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Jones, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Anton Jones, and I represent Brittany Jones, the appellant in this particular case. This case focuses on several issues. One of the issues that we're more concerned about is the variance in the indictment. As the court is aware from reading pleadings, that in this case, the jury returned a verdict in which my client was found guilty of a conspiracy. Conspiracy and indictment alleged to have taken place on April the 25th through May the 19th. The evidence in the case showed that Ms. Jones was assuming arguendo she was involved in the conspiracy at all. Her involvement took place in a shorter period of time. Her involvement only included April the 26th and April the 27th. In that particular time, our position is that there were multiple conspiracies here. What happened was Ms. Jones is alleged to have met the two victims in this particular case on April the 26th and ended her involvement with him on April the 27th when she was physically threatened and forced or banished from the enterprise. At that particular time, there was uncertainty as what was going to take place, although the overwhelming indication was that there was going to be some sort of sexual trafficking or maybe even strip parties, but the two people involved, the two victims involved, were going to be involved in that. However, there was an incident in which Brittany Jones was instructed to transport the individuals to a location, and nothing took place at that particular location. Because of that, Brittany Jones was banished from the organization. After that, what happened was that the individuals were transported to a hotel. In that hotel, there were sexual acts that were performed for customers. Brittany Jones wasn't there. She wasn't involved. She had been banished from the group. All that evidence came out in trial. Next, what came out is after that first stint at the hotel, there was another stint at the hotel. And then subsequent to that, the individuals left or escaped. And that was approximately May the 11th when that transpired. Now, our position is all the evidence came through at trial, talking about what happened at the hotels, who was involved in it. And our position is that it's a variance in the conspiracies here. There was one conspiracy in which Brittany Jones may allegedly have been involved in, but a separate conspiracy in which she was banished outside of it. And that's what transpired here.
Am I right, though, that the record shows that Ms. Jones had ZS and THY there as, I think she said, girls who wanted to work. And she's the one who, when the work at the one person's house didn't turn out, contacted Mr. Lewis about getting work for them, and then drove them to Mr. Lewis. And then actually, after that contact with Mr. Lewis, drove them to another location where they were supposed to have this commercial work performed. And it was only after that fell through that she separated from Mr. Lewis. But she actually was the one who took the girls to him, told him they wanted to do this type of work, and made an effort at that first opportunity.
Yes.
Am I reading the facts correctly?
Yes. I would agree, but there's something to add to that. Okay. Yes, she did come in contact with him, met with Mr. Lewis, and they were supposed to do something at the residence involving where Mr. Lewis was at, and that didn't work out. Then there was a customer that was supposed to meet them and meet one of the young ladies at Greenbelt. They called Ms. Jones to take them there. She went there. She didn't like how the situation was. That didn't work out. They came back and she explained that to him.
Mr. Lewis.
Right.
Brought them back to Mr. Lewis a second time.
Became upset. Mm-hmm. That it didn't work out and that Brittany Jones was one of the reasons.
I understand that she's upset and then she's like, okay, right. Goodbye. But she, even if we assume there were two stages, it's conspiracy, she was the bridge that brought ZS and THY to Mr. Lewis, informed Mr. Lewis that they were looking for commercial sex work, and made a first run out to Greenbelt with them. That went, felt she made a judgment call, brought them back to Mr. Lewis. So at a bare minimum, she was, even if we assume sort of again two series of events, she was the bridge between the two, and she's the one who maybe performed the most significant act in instigating the sexual mistreatment of these girls by bringing them to Mr. Lewis and telling him what he could do with them.
Well, it's unclear whether they were going to have commercial sexual acts at first when she brought in Mr. Lewis, or they were going to be involved in...
She told him they were looking for work.
Right, which also could involve striptease, because they were talking about having... they were talking about stripping as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that... It was unclear exactly what. However, I must agree that going to Greenbelt, there was going to be some, at least there was a thought of commercial sexual activity. However, there was no indication of all of them staying in a hotel, having people come to the hotel. All that happened next. That's a totally different enterprise, which she was banished from. And given that overlap had nothing to do with Brittany Jones, and that's where the variances and the conspiracies are concerned, because it became a different operation, a different term. It's almost as if you and I were going to be involved as partners in the business. You bring the supplies to the business. You purchase, take care of the supplies. I'm the marketing person, or something to speak. You don't like the way my marketing is going. You terminate the marketing. You get someone else. You do some other marketing. I don't get money. I'm not involved in your enterprise anymore. Just like Ms. Jones wasn't involved in the enterprise that Mr. Lewis subsequently took.
So, Mr. Jones, conspiracy law tends to be very broad. It's very encompassing of a lot of different time periods and events and people. You know, it seems to me that you're asking us to make new law here that will make conspiracy harder to prove, that will, this is not consistent with my understanding of how conspiracy law works. Because, you know, sometimes we see cases with, you know, drug conspiracies that lasted 20 years, and some people come in and out of the conspiracy, and some people were in it just for the first 5 years. It's still one conspiracy. I just don't see how your theory fits in with general conspiracy law.
Well, she was forced out, and it's almost a withdrawal. This withdrawal before that.
You didn't argue withdrawal, but also withdrawal is a very high standard.
No, I understand, but she was banished out of the conspiracy at that particular time. If there were a conspiracy.
So you're asking us to make a ruling that in conspiracy law generally, if somebody is banished or forced out, they're not part of the conspiracy, even though they were in it to begin with? I just don't understand what you're asking for here and what that would do to our law about conspiracy generally.
Well, the facts here would, the facts here would indicate that there's no dispute she was banished, she was put out, she was forced out. There's no dispute with respect to that.
I'm and just saying that that's not, I don't think that's an uncommon thing, like just in the world of conspiracies, there's so many of them. They last for a long time. People come in and out of them all the time. And I don't think we've ever held that, you know, under these circumstances, you're not in the conspiracy, or you're not liable for part of the conspiracy you were there for.
Which I now may be liable for the part of the conspiracy you're here for, but in this particular case, it's clear that the conspiracy had evolved or had changed here from...
That's what I'm saying. I just don't think that that's unusual. I think a lot of conspiracies evolve over time. You know, some of them last decades.
I understand that, but the fact scenario here is somewhat different in the sense that we're not talking about a drug case or something along those lines. We're talking about...
But our holding would apply to all conspiracies. No, whatever you ask us to hold, it's going to apply to all conspiracies, and I just don't see how this fits.
Well, it would seem that it would be appropriate, given the fact that Brittany Jones had nothing to do with anything with respect to the hotel situation. That could have been addressed with respect for the proper jury instruction, indicating that...
But that's not how conspiracy law works, is it? I mean, there's an overarching goal that everybody is involved in, the trafficking of these minors, and your client's role was soliciting them, bringing them, transporting them, and then she wasn't there for the hotel part, but that doesn't mean she wasn't part of the conspiracy and promoting its overarching goal.
It would have been different because in this particular case, she was supposed to be part of the conspiracy and supposed to receive some of the proceeds. At least that's what the testimony was. In this particular case, it's clear that she wasn't supposed to receive any of the proceeds involving the hotel or being involved with anything involved in the hotel at all. And that's one thing that's a bit different because we know she was not supposed to be involved in that separate conspiracy. And that's what we was, that's what we say. That's clearly the separate conspiracy. And it's clearly various in this particular case with respect to that particular conspiracy. And we believe all the evidence generated on that is extremely prejudicial to Ms. Jones.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you. Thank you. We'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal. We're having a clock malfunction, so we up here can look at that clock. And then, Ms. Rothenberg, can you give the council the iPad? We'll put an iPad up at the lectern so you can see the time remaining for additional counsel today.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Eve. Ms. Million.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Courtney Million on behalf of Mr. Lewis. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Lewis received a fundamentally unfair trial and sentence. It was fundamentally unfair because the district court made replete evidentiary errors, one of which the government admits to, that combined create a prejudicial error requiring reversal. It gave a plainly erroneous jury instruction, and it abdicated its fundamental responsibility at sentencing to make fact findings in support of its guideline determinations and to offer a reasoned basis for its decision, particularly in the face of an express objection from defense counsel. I'd like to start with the trial errors, but I, of course, welcome questions on all issues. I would like to begin with the district court's Rule 16 error. The district court forbade defense counsel from cross-examining two of the government's important witnesses about statements made in jail phone calls because the district court erroneously believed that those had been improperly withheld under defense counsel's reciprocal discovery obligation. The government admits that this was error.
How do we know how the defense was prejudiced by that? Because no record was made as to what the cross-examination would have been.
So a couple of responses to that. The burden is on the government to show harmlessness. The burden is not on defense counsel.
There's just nothing in the record, though, to show what the harm was, because we don't know what that cross-examination would have been.
First of all, I'm not sure that's the case, but I...
So what What would the cross-examination have been, and where is that in the record?
So we don't have a specific discussion of what the cross-examination of those particular witnesses would have been, because that information...
Isn't that necessary to know what the harm was from this error?
I mean, to the extent it's necessary to know what the harm was, the government fails to prove harmlessness.
Regardless of the burden, I just don't see anything in the record that allows us to evaluate the harmlessness or not.
So a couple of points on where I think we can understand where the harm comes from. First, the government fought tooth and nail to keep this evidence out. It filed reconsideration motions.
Not what the analysis is it? It has to show how the trial would have been different if this cross-examination had taken place. And it's kind of the job of the defense attorney to make a record and say, Your Honor, this is what we want to cross-examine about. Sometime during the course of, or even after the witness is done, like, you have to make a record or else we can't evaluate how this affected the trial. We just don't know. It's not there. We don't know what this cross-examination would have been.
So, I mean, obviously, ideally, I wish a proffer had been made. I think that would make things simpler for everyone here.
How do we do this? You're saying we can still do it. It's just not as simple. I just don't see how we can evaluate this. And it can't be just based on how hard they fought. Like, that doesn't show harmless error.
So I didn't finish my answer on what is in the record. So I want to make a couple of points on this. First of all, I think we can understand harmlessness in part because or the absence of harmlessness here, in part because we have evidence of what happened when those jail calls were used with other witnesses. And we discuss at length in our briefing what happened with Taylor and the way that evidence was powerfully used to impeach her. The fact that she wanted her phone hidden, the fact that she was talking with her father about engaging. I mean, the defense at trial was that it's Taylor's fault rather than...
Doesn't it have to be tailored to the testimony of the witness that you wanted to impeach? Like, just saying that this same evidence was very effective in impeaching some other witness who had different testimony doesn't tell me how you would have used it with respect to the ones that you're saying there was error with respect to.
I don't think that the case law says you cannot ever look at what was introduced and how evidence was used effectively.
But I still don't understand, like, how your client was prejudiced by not being able to use those jail calls to impeach the particular witnesses that you're saying
extent we don't know precisely how it would have been used. I realize I'm repeating myself here, but I think that's the government's problem because it's their burden to prove harmlessness. The reason this is not in the record is because they fought tooth and nail to keep it out.
What if they prove harmlessness by saying it's just not in the record and we don't know what the harm is? I just don't think this is a burden issue. I think this is a gap in the record issue.
I mean, it sounds like we disagree on this point, and you're obviously the judge here, but I would also just note that in this dialogue, I mean, the district court was extremely angry and incorrect in its assessment.
If I agree with you that there was error here, I still have to assess harmlessness.
I just want to finish the point quickly. The court cut off defense counsel and said, bring in the jury. There was, I think, to the extent there's fault in a record not being made, it falls with the district court.
We've got very experienced defense counsel here. And after the witness testifies, what they should have done, which I think you agree, is, Your Honor, I just want to make a record on your exclusion of the jail calls. And I just want to say, this is what they would have shown. That's what should have happened.
I still think this is reversible error, given where the burden falls, but I understand that Your Honor obviously doesn't agree with me on that point.
Do you have a case or cases that establish that proposition, that in this kind of situation, because of where the burden lies, the absence of a record falls to the detriment of the government?
I don't have a particular case, but I think it follows from, like, intuitive first principles. And I've not seen a case where, you know, a court has said you can't establish harm based on, you know, how this evidence was used with respect to different witnesses, nor that if it's not in the record, the defendant necessarily loses because of this burden issue. I have not seen that particular case.
Well, I mean, I take a point on the use of the evidence for another person, because in theory, if that evidence directly applied, I mean, there's no reason not to use it. I understand that. But there's a separate question about whether you project evidence that's targeted at somebody else to this scenario. But on the initial question of whether in a circumstance in which there's an arguable error, but there's a question about harmlessness, and there was no record made through a proffer or anything like that, that it's on the government that they can't prove. I totally understand the legal point that the consequence of that error falls on the government when the burden is on them to establish harmlessness. But in a circumstance in which there hasn't been a record developed by the defense or a request to make that record that was denied, I'm just wondering whether we have law that tells us what we do in that situation.
I don't have a specific case to say to you.
What do we take? You haven't raised an ineffective assistance of counsel claim for failure to make the proffer, although I think kind of, as you said, ideally that would have been done here, would have made at least our analysis much easier if the absence of the proffer were materially prejudicial in a Strickland sense, then wouldn't you have made an ineffective assistance of counsel claim here?
I worked for the Federal Public Defender. The lawyers below were members of the Federal Public Defender's Office. I cannot make that argument. Okay. There's a conflict there.
Can you address the sentencing here? I do think it's problematic the way the sentencing proceeded. And I guess there's a number of sentencing errors that you've asserted. If we think that there's an overarching problem with the failure to make findings and address specific arguments, is that just kind of a global remand, or do we need to address every issue that you've raised?
I think a global remand would be appropriate here. I do think, particularly on the vulnerable victim enhancement, we've made a clear argument that on this record, it just could not be sustained. So I think it would be.
I was wondering about that. Is that something that we should decide, or should the district court decide in the first instance? Because the district court never said which theory it was relying on in applying that.
So, I mean, I think ultimately that is to your honor's discretion. We would obviously encourage, and I think clarity would be appreciated on like what the appropriate test is for the vulnerable victim enhancement. I think, you know, we're likely to end up back here if there isn't some clarity on that particular question, which, you know, there's case law in the circuit saying, you know, it's an open question how we should understand the vulnerable victim enhancement. But I do think, you know, the court can offer that clarity, or can, quite frankly, you know, it's within its discretion and how it resolves its case to sort of
what just is the do right a global test? Remand. I find this very, courts are all over the place. I find it rather difficult to wrestle with. So what is the right test for defining whether someone's a vulnerable victim, at least in a context like this, where you're dealing with a sexual abuse of minors, where everyone is almost inherently vulnerable because they are minors abused by older people? What is the right test?
The right test is someone vulnerable relative to a typical victim of the offense?
How do we decide who a typical victim of an offense like this is?
One is case law. I mean, there's considerable case law on youth, on poverty, on, you know, disassociation from family and friends, remoteness, being the kind of things that are tragically prototypical of victims of sex trafficking.
Those are also tragically prototypical of what it means to be vulnerable to this crime.
True, but I think that feeds into the point that this is, you know, what animated Congress to make this a crime, and a crime with such a severe guidelines range. I mean, we're talking about life here. The idea that vulnerable people are preyed upon is baked into the guideline here. And, you know, given the discussion in the guidelines commentary about how if it's incorporated into the offense guideline, and, you know, the example with the bank teller, That indicates that the type of test we're talking about here is vulnerable relative to the offense of conviction. And I just, to the extent the court's
concerns with this theory, counsel, because it just seems to me that the bank teller analogy is, you know, if the guidelines about bank robbery, you don't get an enhancement because it's a bank teller. It seems to me the correct way to apply that to this situation is it's a minor, so you don't get to be considered unusually vulnerable because you're a minor. But that doesn't address being a runaway, being from foster care, being homeless, being drug addicted, being mentally. It just seems to me troubling as I was reading some of the cases that were being cited that we're going to say that people who are homeless and from foster care, and some of them are 12 years old, are not unusually vulnerable because as a class, they all are unusually vulnerable. I just think that's really difficult to apply. I find that really troubling.
I guess I would say, I mean, to the extent the court is concerned that, you know, these sentences are not going to be high in sex trafficking cases when vulnerable people are being preyed upon. I mean, the guidelines, again, are exceptionally high here. So I just don't think that one needs the vulnerable victim enhancement to capture this type of concern.
I also have a logistical issue, which is the trial judge then has to make a finding in each of these cases what the typical vulnerable victim is. And are the parties going to brief that? Like, how... I mean,
as I said, I think it can be resolved based on case law. But if Your Honor doesn't think it can be,
you're going to submit a brief to the sentencing court that says based on this case law, or I guess you would need statistics or something. Typical victims of trafficking have these characteristics. I just think there's a difficult logistical fact finding issue as well that would be incorporated into this theory.
I think so. As I've said, I'm not so sure it's that difficult given that you can rely on case law. But setting that aside, I think sentencings are difficult. We have very complicated questions sometimes, and like apportioning loss and things like that, that district courts are required to engage in that involve statistics and numbers and things like that. And, you know, I think
each case you would have to say, runaways, X percentage of trafficking victims are runaways.
I think that would be one way to do that. I don't think the case...
X percentage of trafficking victims are homeless. It just seems... I think this is hard. Even if those statistics exist, I think this is difficult.
The fact that it's difficult doesn't mean that it's not the right test.
No, I agree. But I'm just saying this whole thing troubles me. Both logistically and analytically, for courts to be making factual findings that a homeless, penniless runaway who's been through foster care and is desperate is not unusually vulnerable is hard for me to swallow.
And I would also sort of, in response to that, I would also note the district court also just didn't make fact findings about what Mr. Lewis knew or should have known.
We're just talking about the proper test here, and I'm having trouble with it.
Yeah. I mean, and perhaps that counsels in favor of just sort of a broader remand where these issues can be more sort of fully.
Is your idea of the way that this should work? We have the option of, if there was error, to remand without setting the law on this and allowing for some further development. But is your idea of the way that this should work is it's actually just about majority, non-majority. So as it would have to be a situation in which the circumstances of the particular victim are unusual in that they're less than 50%. And I know we can always do the percentage game where we say, you know, exactly what percent. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to know, what's your idea of the overarching standard? Would it be that the circumstances of the particular victim are unusual in that, if you combine all the circumstances, less than a majority of the victims of this particular offense will have those characteristics?
So I don't think it's quite that, because you could be unusually unvulnerable. Like, it could be that it's not these particular assortment of characteristics of someone are like not typical, but that assortment of characteristics actually makes them less vulnerable than the typical victim. So I don't think it's just like identifying characteristics and then saying, do most people have these or not? I think it needs to, one needs to, and I don't have a fully fledged out answer because candidly, I'm personally satisfied by the case law, the way the case law has resolved this, because I think, you know, sometimes we have great precision in sentencing, but oftentimes it is a bit of a gut instinct. And, you know, often I would wish there would be a lot more precision in how we do this kind of stuff. And courts say, no.
But what is the gut instinct? I don't deny any of that, but what is the gut instinct towards? What would we expect the judge to have a gut instinct by reference to?
The idea that someone who is like in poverty or doesn't have resources or is young are the kinds of things that are typical of victims of sex trafficking. And, you know, in this case, we have testimony from an expert that these are the kind of adversities that she sees all the time in her practice. So I think this is, you know, there is stuff in the record about this as well.
But I mean, people who are not young are also victims of sex trafficking.
True. But the guideline here is based on the idea that, the only reason we're applying 2G1.3 is because the victims here are minors.
Right. But I'm trying to determine whether it's unusual or atypical or.
Well, it is not unusual of sex trafficking of minors for someone to be a minor.
If you use that as the baseline.
Yes. And that baseline comes from the guidelines. That comes from the fact that 2G1.3, which is the guideline they're sentenced under, only applies if it's sex trafficking of a minor.
Do you have a case or a circumstance where someone was found to be a vulnerable victim under the sentencing guideline that you think was appropriate that didn't involve reference to common criteria? I'm struggling to figure out what would make someone vulnerable.
So I think what would make someone vulnerable.
Are there any? There's no cases.
So we cite a case out of the Tenth Circuit. I want to say it's called Smith, but it's in the briefing where the victim in that case was found unusually vulnerable because she was found to be like unusually sort of like small and weak relative to other minors.
Physically small and weak.
Yes. I mean, I don't find that especially satisfying, but that at least like begins to engage with the proper analysis and is certainly not something found here. To me, a better example would be, and I don't have a specific case, but I'm not saying it doesn't exist, where like if someone was handicapped and that's why they were trafficked, I feel pretty comfortable saying that that is someone who is unusually vulnerable by virtue of, you know, their handicap.
Can somebody be unusually vulnerable based on the combination of factors that they're a runaway as well as penniless, as well as from foster care, as well as drug addicted, as opposed to looking at each one separately?
I think probably yes. I don't want to get ahead of myself given that, you know, this is going to end up getting litigated below. I think that makes sense, but I think the factors identified here are ones the case law say doesn't make you unusually vulnerable. They're talking
about. I'm just asking if these factors in combination.
I would not say that
come up with
these particular, I mean, whether a particular set of factors that exist might.
I guess the question is if you could have several factors that in and of themselves wouldn't be atypical and take age out of it, because even if you take age as the baseline because of the way this guideline is framed, but these other factors, they might individually be more typical than not, but to have multiple of them in the same one, you could do probabilities and 0.51 point times 0.51 is something around 0.25. And so if you layer multiple of them together, then you might be in an unusual situation, whereas you wouldn't be if you just took each one of them as independent. So it seems like you'd have to be able to take into account multiple considerations in combination.
I think that makes sense to me. And I suspect Yeah, I mean, I don't want to keep returning to the idea of needing a mushy test, but I would have a very hard time arguing that that was like reversible error and a misapplication of the test if that's what the district court had done here.
To take into a, take them into account in accommodation.
Yes.
Did you want to talk about the reckless disregard instruction? Or if my colleagues are done, I'm sorry. Are you done
on this?
The district court used at least a paraphrase of an instruction that had been given in other contexts. There doesn't seem to be any settled law. So on what basis could we find clear error?
So I think a couple of responses to that. I think this is more than a paraphrase. First, I think it's more than a paraphrase of the instruction. And I do think the law is settled enough for the court to find plain error. Yes. On the paraphrase of the instruction, there's a very important difference between the instruction that is in Sand and the instruction that the district court gave. And that is that the instruction in Sand at the end of it references the coercion of a minor, that the minor was coerced. And this just repeats the phrase, the fact, the fact, the fact. And if you read it, it's, I think the only fair reading of it is that the court has essentially said that you don't need to be aware of the facts from which one would draw an inference, because it just keeps repeating the term fact. And I think the law is at the very least settled on the idea that you need to be aware of the facts from which one would draw an inference of that there's a risk of coercion. But that's not the instruction given here, given the way the fact is repeated. And when we, you know, interpret a repeated word used throughout something like a statute or an instruction or anything, we tend to think it refers to the same thing.
What about the fact that he said high rather than highest probability? Is that material?
I'm sorry, say that
again. Just required them to find, indicates a high probability of the fact at issue. Taking your points about the fact and issue, but the modern, the Sand instruction required a finding of the highest probability.
I mean, that is obviously a problem as well, because it's lowering the standard on, you know, one's knowledge of the fact or appreciation of the fact.
We're on plain error review, though, aren't we?
Yes.
So you have to show plain, clear, and obvious error. So even if you're right, it has to be something more. And is it even plain? Like, is this something that we've already decided?
So we don't have a specific case that has decided under this statute the meaning of recklessness. I cite a case called Woodhall.
But is that fatal to your argument, though, on plain
error? I don't think it's fatal. I think case law is clear that if it's, you know, you don't need a case directly on point if a norm is well established, or if you have
obvious. And if you've got one out of circuit case,
that's an in-circuit case. It's an in-circuit case, and it's interpreting the meaning of recklessness to require subjective knowledge of the risk. It's a statute that it's whether you're reckless as to whether a 1512 offense is being committed. So it is, I mean, it's not an a statute that is 1591, the sex trafficking statute at issue here. It's not a case about where they're interpreting the exact statute at issue here, but it is a statute that makes reference to it. It is very, very close to this case, and it's interpreting it to require subjective intent. Subjective awareness of the risk.
Could I ask on this issue, for the other prongs of plain error analysis, when you get further down the line, what's the theory under which the reckless disregard would have been the way in which the jury would have found Lewis guilty of these offenses, as opposed to something more than reckless disregard, because he was the one who was alleged to have used the force and coercion? And we have separate issues about whether there were evidentiary errors that allowed the jury to find that element. But if we just assume those away for present purpose, and I do have a question about those, but if we assume those away for present purposes, then what's the theory under which the reckless disregard part of the statute comes into play on the facts of this case?
So the government's theory is that Mr. Lewis knew about the coercion and was doing it himself. But the defense's theory is that's not true, that Taylor was the one engaging in all of this. And so I think the jury could well have convicted Mr. Lewis on the idea that he, you know, a lower standard of reckless disregard that allowed for an objective appreciation of a risk rather than a subjective appreciation, given that the defense's theory was that it's Taylor was the one doing this and Mr. Lewis was off to the sidelines. And I want to apologize, but I really need to grab my water.
Sure. And then for purposes of the plain error standard, the fact that the defense has the theory, I get that the defense has the theory, but in terms of whether the subsequent parts of the plain error standard are satisfied, and take your time, I don't want to.
I'm sorry, please finish what you're saying and all. I can hear if I can't, okay, even if I can't speak.
Sure, absolutely. How do we factor in that the defense, yes, the defense has that theory, but in order to determine whether the subsequent prongs of plain error are satisfied, I don't think we take the defense's theory as a given.
I don't think we do, but we cite case law about the idea that when there's conflicting evidence on a particular point, that can meet the plain error standard or review on third and fourth prong. And here, you know, the government argues about Mr. Lewis knowing and cites, you know, its particular parts of the record for the proposition. And, you know, in our briefing, we go through and cite, you know, conflicting parts of the record. And I think when you have that conflicting evidence under the case law that we've cited, it's, you know, remand is appropriate here.
And I have one question about an antecedent point. And that's just about your argument about the gun, not the gang part of it, but the gun part of it.
Yes.
With Manns. So even if we assume that there was an error under 404, 403 in admitting that evidence, the government makes a harmlessness argument.
Yes.
What's your response to the harmlessness argument? And I take the point that the burden is on the government, but what's your best argument that the government has not satisfied its burden?
I think when a jury hears evidence like someone held a gun to my head and threatened me, someone's wife who they have a consistent relationship with, I think that is a bell that just does not get unrung here. I mean, that is like devastating, horrific information that if I was sitting on the jury, I would think, not because of guilt or innocence in this case, but this is a dangerous man who needs to be locked up. And I just think something as graphic and horrific as that is the kind of thing that demonstrates error, particularly when you have things here like there was no instruction about the proper use of this evidence given at the time. You know, we're talking about cumulative errors here. We've obviously alleged additional errors, and including the fact that the defense was not allowed to cross-examine Ms. Manns with the jury, with the jail calls. I think that establishes the harm.
A lot of other evidence of force, coercion, et cetera, then I don't know that the law is that if there's one particularly graphic one, that it's necessarily non-harmless.
I mean, I think in the 404B context, the law sometimes does reverse, and we cite cases where there was cross-examination or you know, it was brought out that domestic violence was committed. And, you know, independent from whether, there was some evidence of guilt. I mean, this was a very hard-fought case, and the government brought out, you know, its witnesses, its star witness was Taylor, and the defense did an exceptional job of, impeaching her reliability. And, you know, often, particularly today, you have more neutral evidence that is not a witness testimony demonstrating guilt here. But the government, and there are text messages and cell site and all of that, but this is a case where Taylor herself has admitted she was constantly using Mr. Lewis's phone. So that type of objective evidence just is not powerful in the way it would normally be in a case. I think this is a very close case. And I think in that context, hearing about something as horrifying as holding a gun to your wife's head because of some dispute, I mean, I don't see how a jury would properly put that out of their mind and not draw the just incredibly overwhelming inference that this man needs to be locked up because he's a threat to you know, his wife and women more generally.
Yeah, let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions this time. Okay, thank you, Ms. Miller. I'll give you a little time for rebuttal. Mr. Goodham.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, David Goodham for the United States. With the court's permission, I'd like to take the issues raised by my opponent in the same order they were raised just now, starting very briefly first with the variance. Much of this has been discussed in our brief, but most fundamentally, this notion of two separate conspiracies, I think, is belied by the fact that Lewis and Jones, put simply, worked together to traffic the minors. Jones was instrumental in getting the victims to Mr. Lewis. And, you know, this notion that she exited the conspiracy early because of the banishment, well, you know, in a narcotics context, a supplier could provide 3 kilos of cocaine and then step out of the conspiracy. So I don't think that answers the question. Turning next to the
banished?
I'm sorry.
Do you agree she was banished?
It certainly seems like the tenor of the interaction on that April day was such that Lewis was unhappy with her. I think it wasn't necessarily Lewis who banished her, but Taylor took her aside and said something to the effect of, "You need to make yourself scarce or we'll both end up dead." But there definitely seems
to be. On April 27th, during the conspiracy, Lewis.
Yes.
Mr. Lewis emailed a copy of his loyalty contract to Ms. Jones.
So yes.
It seems like, at least in Mr. Lewis's eyes, she was not banished.
Yes.
Needed to be cooling down for a couple days.
Possibly. Certainly seemed to suggest that.
Surprised you would agree with the banishment characterization, given that there was a later contact between the two of them related to this process.
I think inferences can be drawn on either side. My point simply is that it's irrelevant to the ultimate decision on in terms of variance. With respect to the gun and the issue of harmlessness, as we've articulated, we think there are a couple routes for permissible admission of the gun. First, it was direct evidence of the felon in possession. Second, we do think it related.
Hang on, did you argue those as the basis for admission to the district court?
Certainly there was
the government.
I'm sorry.
Did the government argue those?
Well, my opponent has conceded it's relevant direct evidence.
I mean, this is a discretionary judgment whether something comes in. And if and there's other circuits have said, you know, if you just want to show felon in possession, that's fine, but don't go further and have much more graphic evidence about how the gun was then used.
Sure.
And so since there's a balancing required and the government did not at trial argue, we want this admitted for felon in possession purposes. How could this court make that balancing, whether this evidence and the sort of toxicity of it was warranted to show felon in possession?
I think this
You're
court
has to make that judgment for the first time.
Well, I think this court
balancing judgment.
I think when there are alternative bases for admission, this court can make a determination, even if it wasn't relied on by the district court.
What is your best case that when it involves a discretion, an exercise of discretion by the district court, that this court can make that decision, discretionary decision in the first instance? This court can make all kinds of legal rulings
sure.
in the first instance.
Sure.
Generally, when something involves an exercise of the district court's discretion, especially something as sensitive as as, you know, a balancing of prejudice and prohibitiveness and exactly how much information needs to be let in to demonstrate, for example, felon in possession.
Sure.
That's a judgment that needs to be made by the judge that is sitting in the courtroom.
Well,
all day, every day.
My opponent, you know, when this was litigated during Manz's testimony, my opponent didn't raise the issue of 403 at all. And so I think to the extent that there
I'm
was...
I'm asking you if you have a case that has said that this court can, in the first instance, make that type of very delicate balancing when it wasn't argued that way to the district court. And the district court didn't have a chance to exercise its expert discretion on the issue. What is your best case?
I don't have a case.
Any case.
I don't have a case at my fingertips. I apologize.
Or any case where a court of appeals had made that type of discretionary judgment in the first instance.
I think this court assesses discretionary decisions all the time. But
when they're made by the district court judge, absolutely. We do not make the discretionary decision. We evaluate their discretionary decisions.
Sure.
But we don't have the discretionary decision of whether this... To the degree, the way it was introduced here, the story about the gun to her temple.
I agree that's a missing fact. Yes.
A missing fact. It's a missing discretionary judgment. And there's Court of Appeals decision, I think it's the Seventh Circuit, that said you can let the fact that a witness could testify to the fact that they saw the person with the gun, but could not, in that case, go further and testify things about Russian roulette. Being played with a gun. It seems to me that's very similar to this case.
Well, I'm not familiar with the Seventh Circuit mm-hmm. decision. I apologize. But even if this court were to disagree with the conclusion that this was properly admitted, it's certainly harmless. This was an 8-day trial.
But on Judge Millett's point, wouldn't it be plain error review? If it was never raised as a 403 issue, the court never ruled that way. There's no case on point, but it's plain error review on 403.
I think it would be, and that gets to my core point when I mentioned that defense counsel could have, when this was posited to the district court with respect to the gun and Manz. Certainly, defendant was on notice of the gun to the head incident. That was part of the government's pretrial motion in limine relating to the 404B evidence.
Right. So they should argue it's substantially more prejudicial than probative.
I think that's...
Should be excluded under 403. And if they didn't know it was coming and it came, they should have objected contemporaneously and made a 403 argument, and then we'd be where we are. But if they never did that, we're on plain error review, are we?
I think that's accurate.
Why are we on plain error when they made this objection repeatedly before the district court and again at trial objected to the admission of this evidence?
Well, they addressed the 404... B argument that was related to the gun. But again, to my mind, the district court...
They objected to the admission of this evidence.
Yes, but
you're the one who wants to bring up a whole new balancing thing for felon in possession. They couldn't even just on appeal. You want to bring that up. That's not something they could have anticipated.
I think it's not too much to ask when you object to evidence, you articulate why you think it's inappropriately.
Even if you've
not
already had an entire motion in limine before the district court, what's your best case when you've had an entire motion in limine to this, spelled all this out, and now you're in front of a jury and you make your objection again? What's your best case that that is not sufficient? We get plain error review.
Well, again, I think I understand plain error review to stand for the proposition that you can't sort of sandbag the district court and allow evidence to come in. In this case, again, it seems, again, my opponent doesn't disagree with the notion that this is relevant to the felon in possession. And if we understand that concession to stand for the proposition that it has some probative value, then I don't think it's so much to ask to the district court to consider what your basis for objection is.
But it's not asked to admit this as evidence of felon in possession.
Well,
it's not the government's position. I don't understand this world where the government doesn't have to make arguments, but the defense is supposed to have objected to the unmade arguments.
Well, again, as my opponent
has... And if they don't object to unmade arguments, we apply plain error review.
Sure. We disagree on this, but again, even if we're not...
You have a case where you didn't object to an argument that's not made until appeal, and that's treated as plain error?
I don't have the case on...
I can't imagine. I mean, what are defense attorneys supposed to do? I'm objecting to this. And by the way, if the government in some future time wants to argue this, I'm objecting to that.
Well, again, this was not something completely foreign to the defendant.
That's not the question.
This was
completely foreign isn't the question. The question is whether it was the basis on which the government sought admission of the evidence.
Well, the defendant did make a 403 analysis in its response to the government's pretrial motion. So the notion that this was a laden emotional fact is something that everybody was on notice. So
they did invoke 403?
I'm sorry?
If they did invoke 403, then why are we talking about plain error?
Well, they invoked 403 in response to the government's pretrial motion. My point is later they did not make that argument with respect to the actual admission.
So is that what were they supposed to do? I thought what happened was pretrial, this issue came up and then it was tabled.
Yes, it was tabled. Yes, absolutely.
So then the objections that were made before don't carry through? There's an obligation to.
Well, I think they were answering the 404B argument that was made in the government's motion. And the gun had a separate purpose when we got to trial. It was direct evidence of the felon in possession. And if they wanted, and that's an important part of the balancing. You ask the question of how is this relevant and what probative value does it bring? And the gun. Obviously, there was much discussion of the gun at the trial. So the gun is relevant evidence related to at least one of the counts of the indictment.
When there's a back and forth at the trial, the theory that was being asserted for the admission of the evidence was not felon in possession.
It did not specifically arise. No.
Yeah, but yeah. Because it had to do with it wasn't coming in for that purpose. It was coming for a different purpose.
Well, again, that was the way it was argued pretrial for sure. Then it was pushed off. But I certainly think it's a fair inference that everybody understood that this also had relevance to the felon in possession.
I don't understand fair inference that everyone understood. Where in your brief to us have you argued that this issue, the admission of this testimony, is subject to plain error review?
It's not in our brief.
You argued that it was abuse of discretion review.
Yes.
Okay. And even if one thought it was, you have forfeited that.
I could see the court's perspective.
Or maybe
we
should understand that you understood the record the same way defense understood the record, and that is that this was a preserved argument, and that the shift to felon in possession is something that's made on appeal, but was not made before the district court judge.
Well, again, it wasn't overtly made for sure.
What was made and what the district court relied on was that this would be this very, very potentially toxic or potentially prejudicial, but certainly toxic evidence was going to be admitted subject to the government connecting it up to the argument that it was argued that this would show coercion, that he was someone who engaged in coercive levels of force. And the government promised in limine and at trial that it was going to connect it up to show that the girls were aware of this incident. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. What evidence did the government ever have that the girls saw this incident?
That the girls were aware of this incident? There is no evidence that I know.
Was there ever?
I'm sorry?
Was there ever?
Not in the trial that I saw, no.
No, and by the time this came in, Ms. Demands testified at the end of near the end of the trial, correct?
I don't know exactly.
CS had already testified, and the government didn't ask her if she was aware of this incident, had even heard of this incident, let alone seen this incident. So the government, right there, with ZS on the stand, it didn't do what it said it would do. And every other witness pre-man never had any foundation laid for connecting this incident to the argument about use of coercive force against the girls.
True.
Yet the government, when Ms. Manns comes to testify near the end of the trial, goes ahead and puts it in knowing that the promise it made to the district court judge about connecting it up was not going to happen. It hadn't happened. The questions weren't asked of anybody, let alone the most material witness, ZS. It was nowhere in the grand jury testimony of THY that was read into the record. And as you've said, there was never any evidence in the record that did tie it up. And yet the government went ahead and put it forward before the jury.
Well,
what are we supposed to do with that?
Well, there were two routes for admission pursuant to 404B relating to this incident. The first, as Your Honor has identified, was that the girl's knowledge would constitute direct evidence of the climate of fear. But the other route to admission for this 404B evidence and was argued pretrial was the same rationale that was used with respect to Ashley Taylor. That is, it answered the question of whether the defendant, Lewis, acted knowingly with an intent to coerce, use force or threats of force. And in this context, it showed that he did it both with respect to the victims, the minor victims, but also his underlings in the conspiracy, both Ashley Taylor and his wife, who was also a co-conspirator. So, and in fact, when you look at the—
There's some offense here for coercing underlings that was charged?
No, but I think it's—
Okay, then I don't understand how this evidence was relevant to the charges before the jury.
Well, again—
he's a violent man who should be locked up.
I don't think it's that simple. I think the 404B relates to, and this is the Geddes case from the Eighth Circuit. This was a 1591 prosecution. It involved prior acts of violence, physical assault, and a threat to kill his girlfriend, his ex-girlfriend by the time of trial. And Geddes said the ex-girlfriend's testimony about the defendant's earlier use of force against her was relevant to the issue of the defendant's intent, which was a material issue at a trial. So I think this was
I don't know all the details of that case right now off the top of my head, but it doesn't connect it up for me. How was this relevant to his intent to use force to coerce the girls into commercial sexual acts?
Well, it showed that when you're asking the question, coercion was put in play. The defendant—
coercion for a particular purpose, not does he coerce people to do other things. That's propensity. That's saying he's just a violent man. That is exactly the definition of propensity.
Well, again—
How do you define propensity?
That's the definition that I understand.
Great.
Yes, I don't think that's what this was used for. I will say,
I take it the government's theory is, if Lewis were in the presence of the two minors brandishing a firearm against his wife who was there, and then he said, "This is what happens when you don't pay attention to me and do what I say," and he says that to— in the minor's presence to the minors, then I could see, that's a theory about force and coercion. I'm a coercive guy. I use coercion. You see how I'm doing this. Don't disobey me. Do what I need you to do. You may not need that kind of explicit connection made by Lewis himself, but I take it, is that roughly the government's theory, is that
That was the first route of admission that I was articulating. Again, the second route— I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
The second route to admission is a mirror image of what the trial court did with respect to Ashley Taylor. And that ruling preceded this one, and it was, that's the July 12th, 22 p.m. transcript. At 54, the court considered violent acts against Ashley Taylor that were not necessarily known to the victims. And the court said Taylor was Lewis's bottom, who was acting on his behalf because she was afraid of his violence. And then the court did a 403 balancing test analysis at that point. Again, that's page 54.
It may have gone to Taylor's own liability.
I
rest being a defense.
Well, again, the government offered as proof of the mens rea relating to Defendant Lewis, and that was the
mens rea for what?
Mens rea of Defendant Lewis.
For what?
For which element? To show what?
Intent to commit coercion, force of threats.
For what? I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I'm sorry, I just didn't quite hear it. Intent to commit coercion for what?
Force of threats. I mean, threat of force.
In the abstract?
No, it related to the defendant's activity in the course of this conspiracy.
Okay. When did this incident with Ms. Manns occur?
I'm sorry?
When did the incident with Ms. Manns occur?
It was specified within the time frame in the conspiracy.
No, it was specified as April 2019.
I believe the question was...
They never asked her the date. The conspiracy didn't even start till the 25th of April. So the vast majority of April was not even part of the conspiracy.
Right. That was the trial assistant at page 82 of the 517 transcript, AM, said she was confining it to the time frame of April 2019. But of course,
that's not the conspiracy.
Well,
24 days of April 2019 are not the conspiracy.
Well, I understand.
23.
On or about, we know that conspiracy indictments don't always necessarily have precise dates.
This one is pretty precise. We know the dates. The girls' eyes were found. This one has a pretty precise one.
Yeah.
What happened April 1st or 2nd?
Yeah.
Would that fall within this conspiracy?
I think it could.
He's just violent on April 1st or 2nd?
I think it could, well, if we're talking about on or about.
The government didn't tie this up. It didn't tie it up to the girls as it had promised the district court, the whole basis for letting it in. It's got no tie up to the conspiracy itself because it didn't ask the date, which would have been the obvious thing to do. In fact, it even argued that, wow, this was important. The fact that the gun was held to her head was how she would remember the date, but never asked her the date. This was, I think, as you said, to show propensity for coercive force. That's what you said. And that's just not admissible.
For the record, I just want to be clear. I'm not conceding this was propensity evidence. If you're suggesting that my answers reflect that, I want to make it clear that's not what I'm doing.
We asked you what was relevant for, and you said to use coercive force.
The intent. That's intent
to use absence coercive force.
If I can, I would like to address the harmless part of this.
I want to hear that, actually. But I want to make sure I understand this. So this provision says knowing or in reckless disregard of the fact that force threats, force, fraud, or coercion will be used to cause the person to engage in a commercial sex act. For this, for the gun evidence vis-a-vis Manns, who is the person that's the subject of the force, fraud, or coercion to cause them to engage in a commercial sex act?
The subject is the victims.
The minors.
Yes.
Not Manns.
I think that would be right. Yeah, no.
So the minors.
Yes.
So then just to understand the theory is that because he used a gun against Manns, how does that bear on force, coercion, or fraud to cause the minors to engage in a commercial sex act?
Well, I think it facilitated his ability to operate the conspiracy. That is, she was part of the Cash App part of the conspiracy. And in fact, later in her testimony, she made reference to the fact that she only did that because she was...
I see. So
yeah,
it's forcing Manns.
Yes. And he forced Taylor to participate and work with him in the course of the conspiracy, that informs, I think, the intent analysis of 404B.
So he used force against Manns to enable the conspiracy.
Yes.
That involved sex trafficking of the two minors.
Yes.
That's the second theory.
Yes.
Okay, then on harmlessness.
Sure.
So what the burdens on the government to establish harmlessness if it's...
Sure. Didn't involve a substantial and injurious effect. I think we have several features of this case that demonstrate that wasn't what was going on here and that this court can be confident. Number one, this was an 8-day trial. There were over 1,400 pages of testimony. This was 16 lines of transcript. Critically, it also wasn't mentioned in closing arguments, neither the government's initial opening or its rebuttal. More saliently, even than that, we have the acquittal of Mr. Lewis on one of the counts of the indictment. That suggests that the jury was not engaged in sort of a broad brush attack or engaged in propensity-based guilt or innocence adjudication. If they were considering him as just simply an evil man, they wouldn't have had an acquittal with respect to count 13. I would also say the jury heard plenty of other evidence regarding Lewis's violent nature. He choked Ashley Taylor. The testimony relating to that. He choked Ashley Taylor, and the testimony relating to that was he said to her, "If you keep fucking up, I'll kill you." That's at May 13th AM transcript 7576. He grabbed and threatened Jones and said, "I'm going to shoot the whole shit up." That's page 117 of the 5/12/22 PM transcript. He also told Fowler that he'd arrange for a kidnapping to keep him quiet.
How does this go to coercion of the minors again? Because ZS testified that she never saw this violence. So I get that there is conflicting testimony, right? Taylor says one thing, ZS says she never saw violence.
The testimony relating to the choking was that the minor saw that.
I understand it, but then ZS said she never saw violence, and he was never violent towards her or THY that she had seen, and she didn't see any of this violence against Taylor. So I understand you get your evidence, but there's a clear conflict in the evidence, so that doesn't help so much with harmlessness, does it?
I think it does. This evidence was not challenged. And
that's whether it's challenged.
It was properly.
Whether it was evidence that the girls were aware of his threats related to this operation, to them or to this operation.
And with the pieces of testimony I just cited, I believe the testimony indicated they were
what
aware.
What does ZS say about whether she saw him engage in any of the violence acts you've referenced? Obviously, not the Mr. Fowler one.
That might have conflicted with Taylor's testimony, but I believe right. Taylor. That's it. But I don't think conflicts in testimony necessarily negate the harmlessness point that I'm making.
I think it's really so much more important, doesn't it?
There was also substantial evidence of.
Can I just ask on all this evidence? If let's suppose it's undisputed that the minors never knew about or saw any of this. Just, I know you would resist that because there's at least conflicting evidence, you'd say, but just as a matter of theory, if that was never something the minors were aware of, would you still be making a harmlessness argument, or does your harmlessness argument contingent on accepting the proposition that the minors were aware of or saw?
No, not at all. I mean, I think what this back and forth was reflective of is that I had cited that there were other instances of violence that the jury heard. And there is somewhat contradictory evidence relating to whether or not the girls saw that the defendant choked Taylor.
Isn't it correct that your harmlessness argument that you're making right now addresses the idea that Rule 403 was violated and there was unduly prejudicial evidence about his violence that might have influenced the jury.
Yes.
You're saying that is really cumulative of all the properly admitted evidence that showed he was extremely violent. I thought that was...
That's what I'm getting at. And that's why...
Not the knowledge of the victims, which is a separate issue, which maybe you could address. But this is what you're arguing right now is saying to the extent that Rule 403 was violated and there was inadmissible, too prejudicial evidence of violence, that was cumulative of lots of other evidence properly admitted of violence. Is that right?
That's exactly it, albeit okay. I'm much more artfully
but
than
but
I
don't
would.
But you have to show that it was harmless as to the jury's finding of guilt, including the forced coercion or fraud element, right?
Yes.
And what Is your theory that even if the victims, the minor victims, didn't know about any of this, that it still shows harmlessness?
Yes. Yes. Again, because from our perspective, the citations I've just provided was properly admitted evidence that the jury heard otherwise. And so if you're asking the question of how can we be comfortable with the idea that this jury wasn't influenced by this testimony, we can consider whether or not they had pieces of testimony that were of the same ilk. And we know they had testimony that was of the same ilk when we look at the descriptions of the assault on Taylor, the descriptions of the assault on Jones, and the defendant's own admissions when he told Fowler that to keep a witness quiet, he had kidnapped somebody previously and, in fact, you know, was a member of the Crips. So I think that's just a piece of the harmless error analysis here. I want to make that clear. The fact that it wasn't mentioned in the closings, that this was a lengthy trial, tiny bit of testimony, wasn't emphasized. We have the acquittal on count 13, and we do have a limiting instruction, which if this court decides this was improperly admitted, we know that the court instructed the jury, this is at the May 19th transcript, page 42, that you've heard evidence of other acts not charged in an indictment. You may consider them for only the limited purpose that he acted knowingly. So we already have them not being able to use it just for guilt or innocence. And then I would be remiss if I didn't at least go through some of the powerful corroborating evidence that supported both the victims, the minor victims' testimony, and Taylor's testimony. We have the loyalty contract that the defendant wrote that was on his computer. We have the handwritten notes of the rules he had for the victims that were found in the trunk of his Cadillac. We have contemporaneous texts from the defendant, from Taylor to the girls, quoting Lewis. One, for example, said, even though the girls had claimed they were sick and couldn't take commercial sex acts, he said she said you could only sleep if it was okay with Lewis. In another case, they asked if they could sleep. Taylor responded, Lewis said there was not enough money being generated. That's Exhibit 115B. We also have the cooperator Fowler, who was in the jail cell with Lewis for, I think, a good month. And Lewis revealed many details of the conspiracy. He talked about the loyalty contract to Fowler. He talked about the Cash App transactions. He showed him paperwork for that. He even showed him paperwork relating to the motels. In addition, we have the cell site location information, which corroborated Taylor and the victim's testimony relating to the travels of Jones and Lewis. We also have motel receipts in the defendant's name. We have Cash App transactions that were admitted into evidence. And then
I think a lot of this that you're talking about now goes to whether he was involved in the commercial sex activities. That's just a separate question from whether he was engaged in coercion. So, I mean, I think that's all your travel. He had all the financial information, all that kind of stuff definitely goes to that. But I'm not sure it goes to this coercion question.
Well, the loyalty contract, just to pick an example, sir.
No, but then again, you got Zia's testimony. They didn't feel they had to sign it. They didn't feel it bound them to anything. So,
sure. But again,
that goes to, was he in this business? When the victim itself says, didn't feel pressure to me, I can sign it or not.
Well, it was a constellation of factors here. The loyalty contract was one element, the omnipresence of the gun, the assaults that I've already mentioned on Taylor and Jones, that were known to the children,
whether they were known is a disputed fact. For harmlessness, we don't.
But I think
take the view in favor of the government in deciding whether something the government did that was mistaken.
I think even in the context of harmlessness, all reasonable inferences should be drawn in favor of the government.
Is that our case law?
Because we have jury verdicts, I think that's
no, but if the whole point is that the government's error, if we agree that that's what happened here, or the district court's error, whichever way you look at it, we're trying to decide whether it was prejudicial. We have to look at the whole record.
Sure.
And whether it could have had an impact on the outcome of the case. And I'm not aware of any case that says, and we assume, in doing so, we assume hotly contested factual disputes in favor of the party responsible for.
I think my point is more limited. You can't dispense with the evidence, but I suppose you can.
Right.
You can limit its value if it was
not fact. Limited. If you go, well, it actually cuts the other way. If what's the argument is bears on something that is in fact factually contested, and so the improper evidence could have tilted the jury's view on that disputed question of fact.
I think that's a proper way to analyze harmlessness. But again, that's just a piece of the puzzle that we have for harmlessness here.
Colleagues, are they done? Are you done on this?
Yeah.
Could you talk about the reckless disregard instruction?
Certainly, Your Honor.
So this instruction that was given has no precedent. It doesn't match the Judge Sand's instruction in some pretty critical ways. It doesn't match the background, well-established, long-standing rule of what reckless disregard means in the criminal context at all. It totally omits subjective inquiry. So how was this not, and given how contested the question of coercion was, how is this not a harmful error? How is it not an error that was harmful and prejudicial?
Well,
in a plain error sense.
In the plain error sense, I think most fundamentally, I think the prong two is, I'm sorry.
I didn't say anything.
I think prong two has particular resonance here. I know of no authority that has defined reckless disregard in the 1591 context. This one wasn't a mirror image of Judge Sands' instruction, but it was very close to it.
No, it was some pretty serious deviations, high probability and highest probability. Just a plain English material difference.
The fact at issue,
when the fact, I think, must have kept changing through that sentence, or I don't know if the jury even knew which fact or fact they were supposed to, and they were told just one fact when there were multiple facts that had to be resolved in that instruction. That's pretty important errors.
Well, even if we discount, even, and I don't think you should, but even if you could discount Judge Sands, my opponent has not.
Discounting Judge Sands, I'm discounting the instruction that was given here that was material departure from even Judge Sands. It departed from everything that has ever been before as a reckless disregard instruction.
There was a variation for sure. But again, I understand plain error stand for the concept that unless you can show a settled rule of law.
We've held that there's a settled rule of law as to what reckless disregard means in the criminal law context.
Well, again, I don't think that's what the cases reflect, and that's what we've argued in our brief. And in fact, if you look at the Farmers case, the farmers said reckless is this is 511 U.S. 836. Recklessness is not self-defining. So I think if we are accepting the proposition,
of course, that told us what it means in the criminal law context.
Generally,
we have cases saying what it means in the criminal law context.
I'm sorry, do I?
We have case. No, sorry. This court has case saying what its longstanding background meaning is in the criminal law context. Supreme Court said the same thing in Farmer. And there's nothing in the text of 1591 that I hear the government arguing pointed in the other direction. But even if we say, at most, there's two options. There's the longstanding criminal law definition, or there's this Judge Sands I'll call it a definition for purposes of an instruction. But we had neither one here. And coercion was a very contested issue here. And the evidence is, you know, a lot of evidence that was used is troubling in its own right. And given ZS's own testimony, it's really, really, it's a really close question. I'm not saying the government couldn't have won on a proper instruction, but we have an instruction that doesn't fit anything. Are you aware of any court anywhere that has used this instruction from this case for reckless disregard?
I think I cited two in the 1324.
Not the Judge Sands one. The one that was used in this case.
I don't know of any.
Ever been used.
But in the 1324 context, there is similarity.
They followed the Judge Sands.
Yes.
But I'm not talking about the Judge Sands one, because this one is not.
Again, I think it was very close. And if we're talking about variations at the edges, then I think we're pretty solidly in the plain error context, not showing clear or obvious error. If reasonable minds can...
If there were a legal rule that the government had to show a high probability that something happened, and a court instructed the jury that you must find that it happened by the highest probability, that matter to the government?
Well, I think that excises...
Does that matter to the government?
I think that excises...
Does that matter to the government? If the jury, if the law was high probability, that's all the government has to show, and a jury was instead told, you must find it by the highest probability, would that be a material difference in the government's view between the law and the instruction?
I'm not sure I would say it was. I don't
really.
I don't see the significance
between and highest.
I don't.
More probable than not, or beyond a reasonable doubt, not much difference.
I think
highest probability is as high as can possibly be. That's like almost like a reasonable. I'm not saying it's the same thing, but it's a very high standard, almost like reasonable doubt. High probability. That's just more likely than not. It's even less than more likely than not. I'm not sure.
Again, we disagree about this, but if we're talking about plain error and clear, obvious error, number one.
The fact at issue, that's not Judge Stan's instruction.
If I could turn to prongs three and four, because I don't think the critical question here is whether or not this was a closed case on coercion. I don't think it was. I think the critical question here is whether or not there was any sense that this defendant was somehow or another a bit player in the larger conspiracy where the jury would have to beckon to the notion of an ostrich sticking its head in the sand. And that's the analogy used by the Carson decision out of the Seventh Circuit. This would have more resonance if the government had even mentioned reckless disregard in its closings. It didn't. The primary theory here...
Is that so? I was going to ask that question. Was reckless disregard part of the government's argument?
No. The government...
I mean, the jury obviously could have found it anyway, could have found it on that theory, but I'm just... In terms of the way that it was presented to the jury by the government.
It was presented to the jury in one way. Either you believe that this man was the main player, or you didn't believe that this man was the main player. Reckless disregard just simply didn't come into play. And that's, I think, the Carson's analysis here is when you have significant evidence relating to the actor himself, who is either doing the forcing or the threatening or the coercion, then you don't have to beckon to reckless disregard as a lesser standard of proof relating to mens rea. And I think Carson is directly on point in this regard. It was a 1591 case. It was an erroneous instruction that they found there. But they said that makes no difference except in those cases where you have characters like the driver who just drops off the girls at a designated point. And that is not this. The jury would have had to go off on a frolic and a detour to rely on any purportedly erroneous instruction relating to reckless disregard.
Did Carson not predate Congress's amendment of the statute to change what reckless disregard meant?
I don't know the answer to that. I apologize. I thought Carson dealt with a reckless disregard erroneous instruction, but
it did. But it was okay before Congress amended the statute to resolve a, I think, what may have been a circuit conflict or confusion on a different aspect of reckless disregard. So.
But I think the analysis still holds. If they conclude their reckless disregard instruction was erroneous, but they nonetheless say it didn't have an impact under the prongs 3 and 4, I think that analysis applies here.
And then on, there's one aspect of the sentencing, at least, that if we can go to that, there's one aspect of the sentencing, at least, as to which the government doesn't dispute that findings need to be made, need to have been made that weren't. And so it's, I'm right about that, right?
I'm sorry, I missed the front end of your question.
There's one aspect of the sentencing as to which the government does not dispute that findings needed to have been made but weren't.
I think we said remand may be appropriate. And in that respect, I want to pause here, if I could, and just grab 20 seconds of the court's time. Something that wasn't apparent to me when I was writing the brief, but as we were getting ready for argument, was brought to my attention. And I think it's just important. This court, of course, has an independent duty to do a harmlessness analysis. When you look at the base offense level vis-a-vis the final adjusted offense level, I would note that even on the adjustments that my opponent challenges, we would still come out to a 43 base of adjusted offense level. And so I read the calculations to stand for the proposition that we're not in a different guideline range category. We're in a similar guideline range category. Now, I bring this to the court's attention.
So that's true. If there's remand on all three, the computer leadership and vulnerable victim, I think you're out of the life sentence and into, it's 360 to life, but there is, you're in a range that is not automatically life.
Well, my opponent, I don't think, is disagreeing with the notion that at least a 2-level adjustment for leadership would be appropriate. So I'm only saying the 2 points for computer, the 2 points for vulnerable victim, and the 2 points for leader enhancement would still get you to 43, and that puts you in the same guideline range. But again,
you're,
I bring this
two
to
two points for computer, but you agree that we have to remand for fact finding on that. 2 points for leadership, but the district court didn't make findings about how many people were led here. And then 2 points for vulnerable victim. But even if we had a test for what vulnerable victim means, you have to find, and there were no district court findings, that Mr. Lewis was aware of the facts that made these girls vulnerable, even if we look at the facts that are common to minor sex trafficking. Victim.
I agree that the court did not make findings of fact relating to the vulnerable victim. On that note, as my opponent was arguing, one question related to whether this should be a global remand or a more nuanced remand. McCants, I think, speaks to this. McCants went so far as to say that although the parties urge us to rule on the proper interpretation of this, in that case, sophisticated means enhancement, in the guidelines, it would be inappropriate for us to do so in the absence of more specific factual findings by the district court. And excuse me, that's 434 F3rd at 564. So at least in the context of McCants, a case we cited relating to when you do have important missing factual findings on pivotal sentencing factors. McCants says, well, we shouldn't be in the process. I read McCants standpoint, we shouldn't be in the manner of issuing advisory opinions on the name, on the nature of the enhancement, because I read McCants standpoint for the proposition, it may be mooted out if the district court doesn't even find the vulnerable victim enhancement.
Any more questions?
No? I had just one comment. I think that this sentencing was problematic because the district court, after hearing lengthy allocutions from both sides, did not address the arguments that were made by the defense or the government when it gave its sentence. And I just want to note that the government has an obligation to also make a record here. And I don't see why the prosecutor didn't say, Your Honor, we'd asked for the record that you make some factual findings on issues A, B, C, and D. We've got the defense attorney doing that. I see nothing from the government doing this. And I just don't understand why the government is not protecting the record and making a record to support a conviction that it fought hard to achieve.
Well, I can assume the government, I haven't discussed this with anybody, but I can assume the government was relying on its own pleadings relating to, these were hotly contested issues for sure.
Oh, so you're defending this? You think that this is an appropriate strategic or legal performance by an AUSA at a sentencing hearing after making allocution and hearing the defense arguments and seeing a record that clearly is going to go up on appeal and probably going to get reversed because there are no factual findings that the AUSA should sit there mutely?
I'm just suggesting that we could maybe ascertain why there weren't more vocal objections.
I just don't see why you would defend this. I'm only making this comment for future reference for the government.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
We would ask that you affirm the judgment and conviction. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jones, we'll give you 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Well, the only issue I want to make is since this is rebuttal, the only issue I want to make is with respect to when my client was involved in the alleged conspiracy. She got involved April the 26th and was out April the 27th. Why that is important is because the loyalty contract that came through on her phone, that was presented on April the 27th before she went to Greenbelt with the young people, and after she had been banned. It's when she came back when nothing worked out.
I don't see how that helps. She was aware of the loyalty contract he was going to use with these girls that she said wanted work, and she was bringing to him for that work. And she's seen the loyalty contract. I just don't know how you can say she was divorced from what happened with those girls as part of his trafficking of them.
Well, it's clear that
the loyalty contract says, okay, here's what's going to happen. When you bring them here, here's how I'm going to get them work, and here's what I'm going to require of them.
And then okay,
drive them on up. She takes them to them twice. She takes them to them, and then she goes off to Greenbelt and brings them right back to him.
And nothing happened in Greenbelt because she stopped it, at least according to the evidence, because she stopped it. And because she stopped it, she was...
They didn't keep driving and take the girls away from Mr. Lewis. She had the loyalty contract. She knew Mr. Lewis. She knew what he did. That's why she took them to them for work. And so I just don't quite understand how that allows her to sort of wash her hands of this, of what happened afterwards.
Well, that time she was threatened with physical violence to herself, and she elected to do duress.
I'd peel out from there for then, sure. But that doesn't mean she's not responsible for what happened. Or part of the conspiracy, I should say, not responsibility. Responsibility has many forms in a case like this, many responsible people. But... she's part of that part of the conspiracy.
How was this conspiracy shifted from there? Because at that juncture, they were not going in any hotels. They weren't staying in the hotels. And they did immediately leave there and go to the Motel 6. And then after stayed there for approximately 4 days. And after there, went to the Econo Lodge. So that had nothing to do with her, because that's when they met the people and they were having the commercial sexual acts. There were none done while she was there, or her getting any funds from that, participating in it, of the like. She was out of it and banished.
Okay. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you. Thank you, Mr. Jones.
All right. Thanks.
Ms. Million will also give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. We've been here for a long time, so I don't want to keep us here too much longer. But I just want to note the government has raised a new argument at the podium about harmlessness at sentencing. And I would just note that it's this idea about the 2 points not affecting the guidelines range is something that's been waived because it's not been briefed. And, you know, you're not supposed to bring it up for the first time at the podium. And I'd also just note that notwithstanding that fact, Mr. Lewis received a 2-point enhancement for obstruction of justice based on the acquitted conduct related to Mr. Fowler, and the guidelines range has they've since been amended, and on a remand, we would, you know, raise the argument that the guidelines have changed and those 2 points shouldn't apply. So even then, this issue is irrelevant, given that, you know, on remand, we're going to be talking about a different guidelines range. So that is sort of the main point I had. If there are other questions from Your Honors, I'm happy for them.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take this case under submission.